A few weeks ago, I was attending a conference in Montreal, and my friend Jen Vandermeer mentioned a report out from the American Statistical Society discussing various threats to the national statistical agencies. She very kindly sent me a link to the report, which I devoured, and within a few hours, I was in contact with the principal analyst on this report, entitled The Nation's Data at Risk. I'm really excited to be able to share the key findings and recommendations of this report through an amazing conversation I had with Connie Citro, the former chair of the Committee on National Statistics at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, who, in addition to her work as a consultant, helped to author this paper. Now, I understand that I may have lost you at national statistical agencies, but I'm going to ask you to listen to what Connie has to say anyway, because the truth of the matter is modern democracies, even our 18th century democracy, are founded on evidence-based decision-making. Empiricism was a core tenet of the Enlightenment, and the founders of most democracies, including our own Hamilton and Madison, know that high-quality, accurate data is central to the effective governance of a growing nation. One of my favorite things as both a law nerd and a politics nerd and a researcher is that the Constitution calls for an enumeration of the country's residents and citizens. That is what we know as the census. But it's not just the census. Throughout the Constitution, there are implicit calls for data, information used to levy taxes, organize the military, form courts and executive agencies, manage the nation's finances, and so on. The very first Congress in 1789 set to work creating cabinet-level and other agencies, each with an information-gathering function or need. Today, these statistical agencies collect data that enable the government to use the formulas set by Congress to allocate resources to schools, children in poverty, public health, public safety, public infrastructure. And today, a lot of these data are publicly available. Everyone in business, market research, polling, politics, journalism, we rely on these data sources. At a certain level, almost all of us organize our lives based on programs dependent on government-collected data. We organize our businesses around it. I organize my research around it. The pollsters I've interviewed for this show rely on it in order to set their quotas for sample and their weights for analysis. And the thing is, there is no business case for the private sector to step in and replace it should something happen to these agencies. This is something Connie and I talk about at some length in the show. We also talk about in the show something I feel silly to admit, which is that I'm 20 years into the work of market research and 15, 16 episodes into the show and literally learned in the last month and a half that the word statistics literally means information about the state. But one of the things I want you to think about is just that phrase, information about the state, because it basically appears almost word for word in the Constitution as well. It appears in the section about the State of the Union speech. The actual text reads, "He shall from time to time give to the Congress information about the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient." There's an argument to be made that the State of the Union speech is a constitutionally required research report with a robust recommendation section, which just kind of makes me laugh. But it also means that the president, in order to make that presentation, he needs data. And for us to trust him, for Congress to trust him, we need to be able to trust and safeguard the data he relies upon. This conversation discusses the history of our statistical agencies, the many challenges they now face in the form of funding, technology, access to talent, and potentially increasing political and judicial interference, and what we can all do to ensure that these agencies continue to have the resources and protection they need to continue to do their important work. As always, I hope you will listen to the entire conversation. I hope you will share it with a friend. I hope you will like and subscribe it on your podcast platform of choice. You can also find us on our website, crosstabspodcast.com. With that, I will take you over to my conversation with Connie Citro. I hope you really enjoy it. She's impressive as hell. This show's focus has primarily been on, since we're in a political season, how polling works and political research works. Quotas for political polling are set based on the American Community Survey and the census. We need all this information very, very badly. So tell me a little bit about what you do and how you got involved with this project.
I am a political scientist by training who had statistics and survey methods courses. And I wound up moving from Rochester, New York with my late husband to Washington, D.C. so he could do research in the Library of Congress. And I fell into a job at the Census Bureau. From there, I worked at a couple of places. 40 years ago, I joined the Committee on National Statistics at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. And that committee was set up in 1972 to advise statistical agencies like the Census Bureau on improving methods and so on. I am also a member of the American Statistical Association. Over my 40 years at the academies, I've been involved in studies on the decennial census, on poverty measurement, on the American Community Survey, the Survey of Income and Program Participation, you name it. In my activity in the American Statistical Association, I have worked closely with the science policy advisor, a gentleman named Steve Pearson, who is one of the authors of this report. He has been working hard for the last 15 years on trying to educate Congress about the need to support federal statistical agencies. And several years ago, he came up with the idea of framing it as just like the civil engineers do a review every several years of our bridges and roads and so on and give us C plus or D minus or whatever reports, that there ought to be a review of the federal statistical system. He was finally able to get funding from the Sloan Foundation, to whom we're very grateful, and his co-principal investigator, Jonathan Auerbach, who worked with Steve at ASA and is now an assistant professor at George Mason University. And they got funding from Sloan, and they went and recruited several of us to be part of the project team. We also have a scientific advisory board. We had a lot of reviewers of the report, etc. I directed studies of expert committees. That's how the Academy does its work, like on the census. And then I ran the Committee on National Statistics for a number of years. At age 75 in 2017, I stepped back, and I'm now a part-time senior scholar, and I help with reports where needed. And I also do some consulting work on my own. It was in that capacity that I signed up for this effort. So we began a year and a half ago. We wanted to look at the 13 principal federal statistical agencies and the chief statistician's office in the Office of Management and Budget and assess their health. We talked to lots of people, including, of course, the heads of the agencies, the chief statistician. We had a workshop in the fall where we discussed all this, and we gathered a lot of data. We surveyed, actually, the statistical agencies about a number of things, and they were extremely cooperative because we had kind of a big ask. And then we looked at a lot of publicly available data, and we wrote the report that we released in early July. July 9th, I think it was, the nation's data at risk. And our overall conclusion is that these federal statistics that we all rely on, whether sometimes we know it or not, and we just expect to come out and be high quality and objective, that they are at risk. And the report identifies those risks. In addition to the main report, there's a whole bunch of supporting materials. Mm-hmm. We then had a number of recommendations for actions that we think would help. We hope this report will be annual. We have funding for another round, and we're trying to get our heads around that right now because it was a major effort to pull this together. And we welcome input on anything we might have not gotten quite right, anything. We covered a lot, but we didn't cover everything there is to cover and what people see as priorities for us to continue to look at.
We will definitely share links to the project website and the PDFs right. That people can download. You know, one of the things that I suspect a lot of people may not be aware of is how many agencies are collecting yes. data and how integral to the policymaking process they really are. I think most people are aware there's a census. They are aware that that helps apportion Congress and so on. But there are other agencies collecting data that influence who gets SNAP benefits and where public health investments are made for managing long-term chronic conditions. I confess, looking through the report, I was like a little bit mind blown about how many things hinge on that. And also that there is, in fact, a kind of evidence-based policymaking law that needs to be renewed, it sounds like, and that it also has its own sort of body for this. I was completely unaware that this agency even existed. But maybe you could talk broadly about why agencies collect this data. What do we need data for?
Surely. Data are actually built into our DNA in that the Constitution, you know, calls for a census to reapportion so that power could peacefully be reallocated as the expected expansion of the United States. So the founding fathers were fully confident that we were going to expand and there would be new states and there would be a need to reallocate power peacefully. There was also a clause in the Constitution that talks about Congress getting reports on the state of the economy. Mm-hmm. It's not quite that wording. And Alexander Hamilton, actually, at the beginning, had a whole group of people who were meticulously compiling data on exports and imports because tariffs were the chief revenue source for the federal government for a long, long time. And James Madison, among others, when Congress was debating the bill for the first census in 1790, said, boy, wouldn't it be good to know more than what we're going to ask, which was basically just some numbers and very limited age and slave status and sex. And specifically, he was interested in knowing what people were doing, whether they were manufacturing or farming or commerce. And a question was added to the 1820 census that precisely asked that. And questions kept being added. As policies became important at the federal level, you know, we started out with a federal government that had very basic responsibilities, you know, an army and the attorney general and State Department and Treasury. We then added a number of cabinet departments, and the agriculture department was added in during the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And every department that got added invariably had a statistical function. The authorized legislation said, we want data on whatever the topic was of the department. In the case of the Bureau of Labor Statistics that produces things like the unemployment rate and the consumer price index, that was actually set up before there was a labor department. The burgeoning union movement and industrialization wanted desperately statistics on how wage workers were doing, how they were living, what they were earning. And in fact, the state of Massachusetts and some other states set up statistical departments before the federal government, but they finally did it in 1884. And then the Census Bureau, it used to be that Congress would pass a law and there would be like a census office set up, but it would disband once the publications were out. And finally, in 1902, I believe it was, the Census Bureau was established as a permanent agency. This pattern continued. There was actually a Department of Education set up around the time of the Civil War with the statistics office. The department only lasted a year or two, but the statistics office continued and was lodged various places. And then we had, of course, the Social Security Administration, and they had a great need for data. And they ultimately became part of Health and Human Services before being split off again as an independent agency. So when transportation, HUD, you name it, came online, they all had statistical functions. And in some cases, like the Justice Department, which was set up as a department as opposed to just the Attorney General under the Grant administration and played a really important function in the demise of the first Ku Klux Klan, getting that under control. And FBI started collecting statistics in the 1920s. And then as, again, the federal government got more involved in the 60s and the 70s in funding police work and working with the states and localities, because policing has always been a local function, there was a statistics office set up, which is now the Bureau of Justice Statistics. So it just went on like that. In the 30s, there was a viewed need to have some better coordination, and something called a Central Statistical Board was set up, which in fact the American Statistical Association recommended. And then that became what is now the Chief Statistician's Office in OMB, which used to be the Bureau of the Budget. So we have these 13 principal agencies, the Chief Stats Office, and then there are a whole bunch of other statistical programs. Various units of NIH conduct big surveys, et cetera. This is unlike most other countries. Most other countries have like a Statistics Canada or a Statistics Norway or something like that. There have been a dozen or so studies, which we document in one of the supporting materials, starting in about 1903 of the statistical agencies, many of which have recommended that they be combined, or at least the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the Bureau of Economic Analysis be combined. But once you get a department having an agency, and then that usually corresponds to a congressional committee that has oversight, nobody wants to give that up. So those recommendations have never gone anywhere. And we, in fact, say we're not going to expend limited capital on arguing for a more centralized system. What we do argue for is greater recognition and autonomy and resources for these agencies, some of which are really buried in their departments, and then much greater resources for the Chief Statistician's Office, which until a year or two ago had six actual positions. Plus, they get people on detail, you know, somebody from the Census Bureau comes over. They've now actually got 12. They used to have, back when, many more staff. And there's a whole history there of why that contraction happened and so on. If we're going to have a decentralized system, there's just too much. It's just too heavy a lift to try to do something about that. There's got to be a bigger, better coordinating function that can do things like strategic planning and priority setting and that kind of thing. But that's how the history was. Our states handled a lot of functions like police and education. And as they got a federal concern or federal money could help, we got departments. And with those departments, we got a statistical agency.
I have to confess, as someone who's been working in market research for 20 years, I didn't know the origin of the word statistics. So I didn't know that it is actually information about the state. I think it is interesting to have this grounding, because the need for agencies to have information that they can use to base decisions, policies, investments of resources makes a lot of sense. Like, otherwise, how do you know who needs what, right?
How do you know what to do and what you're doing? And there are all kinds of examples. A lot of programs, you know, allocate funds by formulas. So Congress doesn't have to decide all the time. Community development block grants and Title I education funding. And they use federal statistics, population, income, poverty, housing conditions, some of those. So that's a very important use. And again, evidence building. And then, of course, a whole industry actually has grown up around, you mentioned ESRI, around adding value to federal statistics and making the enhanced products that they sell available to a client base, which is why I say there are probably many people who are not quite aware of where the underlying data are coming from. And in fact, in the Eisenhower administration, when Eisenhower took office, that party had not been in the executive branch for a long time. And so they were looking around to save money and so on. And they were saying, well, why do we need the every five years economic census of businesses? And they consulted business friends who said, oh, my, you know, analyst gets me the data. So they did not take an economic census as scheduled. And then everybody looked around and realized that the economic census was the basis of the data that those company analysts were giving to their bosses. And there was a commission, there was an investigation, wow. And there is now a law that says every 5 years there will be an economic census plus a bunch of surveys in between.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yes.
One thing we should also do to set the table is not all of the data being collected is surveys.
Absolutely.
So maybe talk a bit about the other sources of data that these agencies rely upon besides sending surveys to business or to citizens.
Yes. And surveys began in the federal government during the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And the whole theory of surveys and probability sampling had really just been kind of worked out. And there were leading lights. Morris Hansen is a revered name that develop survey sampling techniques that would actually work in practice and all kinds of different designs. The idea was that censuses is what you take when you really want to ask people things, but censuses are very expensive and they have their own errors. But other data, what's usually called administrative records, for instance, tax returns of businesses and people and enterprises and so on, the statistical agencies have legislation that very strongly enjoins them to protect confidentiality. So they are not letting out anybody's tax return, but they are using that data, Social Security data too. For instance, the economic census that I spoke of does send what amounts to surveys to larger businesses. For the millions of single, like a consultant, mm-hmm. on their own, or maybe with a couple of employees. That would be a nightmare logistically, and people talking about, why are you bugging me? You know, I don't have any time to answer this. So there's a regulation that allows the Census Bureau to use Schedule Cs mm-hmm. from tax returns to identify and get the basic characteristics, mm-hmm. which is essentially revenue and some expenses, without bothering all these tiny businesses. And that is a longstanding program and one that is just invaluable in terms of saving hassle and getting accurate data for minimal cost. Again, the Census Bureau they aggregate the data into tables and charts and they don't let out the individual data. The Bureau of Economic Analysis that does the gross domestic product and national income and all those things does not itself collect much data. They do have a few surveys they do, but they use a whole combination of surveys and records, like tax records, for instance, data from programs like SNAP or unemployment insurance or you name it, records for those programs to piece together what we call blended data, to piece together the data so that they cover the entire economy. So that's really important. Recently, a number of agencies have been acquiring commercial data or scraping the web, as they call it, scraping the internet. And for the Consumer Price Index, the Bureau of Labor Statistics gets prices for airline flights.
Okay.
You don't have to ask people that,
right.
Or send interviewers out. You just go and you look at websites and you get that. So there is a lot of that those kinds of data. Each has strengths and weaknesses, but surveys are still with us because there are a number of things that you can't get except by asking people. Plus, the surveys provide context. Hmm. So a field that I'm pretty involved with is improving income and poverty statistics. People do not report their income well. Hmm. They don't want to, or they don't know the information, and they don't want to be bothered to get it. So there is work now at several agencies to try to use administrative records to fill in the gaps but you need the survey data because that will tell you things like how does income levels look by education or veteran right. status or family type or that kind of thing that you can't readily get from mm. records.
That's super helpful. And I think also speaks to the rise of the popularity of platforms, let's say, like Esri, where you yes. can plug in multiple yes. data sets and start to create these overlays. Yes. As someone who's used to combing through downloaded Excel files from the old census and the old yes. PLS.gov, just having tools now. And that has actually been a real interesting development over the last 10, 15 years of a lot of those public data sources being made more accessible to the public, yes. where you don't necessarily yes. have to be a statistician in order to find the answer to how many 18 yes. to 24 year olds are there in the United States.
Right. That's right.
What are the challenges of coordination, though? You've got a lot of different agencies collecting a lot of different data. How good are they at sharing? Do they have to share? Or how does that work?
Well, there are several legal barriers, mm-hmm. and then there are just some agencies are better at collaborating than others mm-hmm. and the culture and sure. you know, so on. But on the legal issues, take IRS tax data. Again, you do not want that just floating no. around. Absolutely not. And right now, the Title 26 of the United States Code, which is what governs the Treasury Department and the IRS mm-hmm. and so on, there has a provision for there's a process whereby IRS, the Statistics of Income Division, IRS, can allow a particular agency to have a particular piece of tax data for a particular purpose. Mm. They may not share it with any other agency, even another statistical mm. agency. The Census Bureau has most of those allowances in this regulation. Mm-hmm. The Department of Agriculture, the National Agricultural Statistics Service, has access to a couple of items that they use for the Census of Agriculture. And I was mentioning about for the economic census for individual person, solo businesses, mm-hmm. They get them from tax data. There is something called the Confidential Information Protection and Statistical Efficiency Act, CIPSE, which was passed in 2002 due to heroic efforts of the late Catherine Wallman, who was chief statistician then, and is now part of this Evidence Act that has penalties of, it's like $250,000 in fine or up to 5 years in jail for any statistical agency staff who, leak some identifiable information. But despite that, the census cannot share, because of Title 26 and its own Title 13, which governs how it uses data, it can't share like that small business, just even the address and name of the business right. with any other agency. So Bureau of Labor Statistics has its own business list. Bureau of Economic Analysis does its own thing. And again, in a centralized system, this would not even be an issue because like Statistics Canada has access to tax data. They have rules mm-hmm. and procedures, and they don't just use it, because they feel like it. But the point is, they don't actually face a legal barrier that says you can't share this, even though a sister statistical agency is under the same penalties as you, the Census Bureau, are. And in the 2002 legislation that tried to create data sharing within, again, the protected statistical agencies that protect the data, getting the tax data in there was just, it was going to be either it was left out of this legislation or there would be no legislation. And that continues to be the case. And that is one of our recommendations, that amendments to the Evidence Act or some vehicle be used to fix this. It is an artifact of the fact that we have a decentralized system, but it's in there and been in there. The IRS regulatory structure on this dates back to the aftermath of Watergate, because the Nixon administration endeavored to, you know, go after people looking in their tax returns. And a law was passed that said, no, we don't do this. And that was an excellent law. But again, in our decentralized system, we've got this problem. Similarly, states own a lot of useful records, which is birth, death records, unemployment insurance records, SNAP records, even though the federal government pays, in some cases, pays almost all the costs of the program, they've been set up where the individual states control the records. And some states are very cooperative about sharing them for statistical purposes, and other states not so. And then every time there's a change in personnel, the statistical agencies have to renegotiate their agreements. And so that is another thing that should be in this Evidence Act.
This is incredibly interesting because I understand the interests, right? The interests of protecting the data, protecting people's privacy.
Yes.
I hadn't thought about the Watergate connection. You know, those interests in protecting people's data and in whose data is it, you would find the same thing in any large bureaucracy, I'm sure. The other part of that is it seems like it does create, in some respects, more risk because you have agencies collecting duplicative or overlapping data. And so now there's more places I could find information about you. And then to your point about these kind of data enrichment platforms, I could start to connect that probabilistically to personally identifying information. And so having some controls makes sense, but maybe also having more centralization makes sense.
If we're going to have a physically decentralized agency, trying to make it virtually more centralized, and your point about more data out there, yes, we also have a recommendation that says, I told you about these big penalties that are on Cisco agency staff. If you ever go to the Census Bureau's website, you can actually find the training that they offer mandatory for employees on protecting data and go through it. Oh, wow. And it is quite something. One of our recommendations is that the Evidence Act make it penalties for users, which would include companies that add value. It would include other departments of government, like Homeland Security, say, or their contractors, or it would include, say, some graduate student who thinks they're the latest whiz and just wants to show how they can find out things, that it would say, no, we don't do that. We have collected data from the public for statistical purposes of evaluation, figuring out which programs work, how programs could be improved, helping localities figure out where they need social services, where the schools need to be, you know, expanded or contracted for public purposes, for the public good. And those data are not to be used to try to hone in on an individual and expose a business and expose their data. So that is one recommendation that we have. Europe does have such legislation. And oddly enough, the Department of Education has such legislation. It was part of legislation that established the Institute for Education Sciences about 25 years ago. And the National Center for Education Statistics will put up on its website for some of its more sensitive data, here's these penalties. They apply to you as well as to us. Now, you don't want to scare public away from going looking for data, but you want to build a culture of we're all in this together. And it would help the statistical agencies because there are greater threats to privacy and people figuring things out from mixing and matching things, that they are pulling back data into secure enclaves that researchers can use if they're connected and have money from a grant program and so on, or they're reducing the content that they're releasing. Right now, that is fully their incentive. They are at risk.
Right.
The rest of us are not being told, do not mess with these data for harmful purposes or enforcement or, you know, infringing on somebody's rights or outing them in some way. So that package of law is what we are suggesting of amendments to the Evidence Act.
I also think it's interesting to think about, okay, the collection is decentralized, but there could be a virtual centralization of the information itself. That feels like a clever solution to our distributed system. One example I wanted to chat about, because there have been some headlines about it, is some of the employment rate data, and that we are seeing separations between the business survey and the individual survey on jobs versus self-reported employment. Yes. And I'm curious about what's happening there. Why are we seeing those lines pull apart?
Those have pulled apart and pulled together historically for a long time. They generally trend in the same way. But they do pull apart. They are from totally different data sets, one being a survey and one being business records coming through the state employment security agencies, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I once heard a really interesting analysis of why and when they differ. For one thing, the payroll data are jobs. They are not people. People have multiple jobs. Some people do. And of course, some people have less than full-time work. Also, they are payroll jobs. They are not, for instance, off-the-books jobs. Mm. And people will, in the survey, the household survey, will report some of those kinds. You know, they do construction and where they are self-employed, or they, you know, they don't report an employer. Those kinds of jobs that cannot show up in the payroll survey because they are not, somebody's not on the payroll. Right. So when there are economic downturns, I believe it is the case that the household survey will look a little more robust than the payroll survey in terms of employment and vice versa. But it is also the case that COVID-19 really did a number on a whole number of surveys and data programs. Obviously, any survey that was using in-person interviewing had to do something else during COVID. But the household survey has longstanding adjustments called, one thing is seasonal adjustments, because historically there have been patterns like hiring extra people around Christmas and New Year's, or students coming out of school and working and coming back. Right. And COVID and virtual work and gig work and all that has really kind of messed with some of those adjustment procedures. And I know that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, puts out all effort to try to get that as accurately as they can. But that is also the reason why you will see some revisions, also in the payroll survey in particular, because some companies lag in reporting and, you know, they don't get that until later and then they revise the estimates. But they are basically, well, again, one is jobs, the other is people, and people have either no or less than one job or the end, and maybe some, you know, they're dog walking on the side or something. And then also people have multiple payroll jobs. So they will not be
one-to-one
in sync.
Yeah.
One-to-one.
Right.
They will generally trend together. But there again, there have been periods, and not just now, but in the past, where they diverged.
That's super helpful. I definitely saw in the spring some people I knew were trying to figure out, well, I think there were some people who were a little cynical about the revisions and thought that they only ever got revised down. And it's like, no, they also get revised up.
It is a difficult thing. And the experienced users, whether that's the GDP or the employment numbers, learned over the years, people want timely data.
Right.
Right. There is a push. So if you want timely data, there are always going to be some revisions because of some things being late. Some things they figured out that, like, the seasonal adjustment this year doesn't work for factor, you know, Y or X. So the key for the agencies is really to be as transparent as possible and to have people who are knowledgeable be transparent on their behalf because they are trying to get the best number they can at the particular point when it comes out. Agencies have really an unparalleled record of releasing data on time per schedule. I think only twice in recent years have a couple of things like the unemployment rate been late was when the government shutdowns were so extensive that they couldn't get interviewers, they couldn't collect the data. Right. So other countries, I was interested to learn, many other countries do not publish monthly data on things like unemployment. But the trade-off is, if you want it timely and not wait, you know, it comes out on the whichever Friday the month it is, or Wednesday or Thursday, and they do, like clockwork, there are going to be revisions, and those revisions are going to be of different magnitudes and directions for, you know, a whole bunch of reasons. There is an effort, I know, going on at the Bureau of Economic Analysis to try to reduce the extent of revisions there, if for a story about why we need these agencies and why they needed to be funded. In the Great Recession, BEA documented that there was huge decline in GDP. Turned out they underestimated the decline. It should have been about twice as much as what they estimated. Oh, wow. And the reason was, Census Bureau had been asking for some time for money to do quarterly data on every sector of the service sector, which is a very big sector. And they only were able to do some sectors quarterly, others were annual. Some of that included things like computer software. So BEA didn't have up-to-date information at the time it was needed because the Census Bureau didn't have the money to do the survey more frequently, and systems and software was a big decline there. So they, of course, the data trickled in, but it meant that the administration and Congress that were, you know, arguing about the size of the stimulus package were working with data that was underestimating the severity of the problem. Mm. And again, there wasn't anything that the Bureau of Economic Analysis could do about that because, again, the Census Bureau had not had the funding. Now, they got the funding like the year after, and then they were able to reestimate. Right now, you have probably read that the size of the current population survey, which is the source of the unemployment rate on the household size, is being cut because Census Bureau and BLS, Census Bureau does the field work and BLS does the analysis. Neither agency, but particularly Census, has sufficient budget to pay interviewers what's needed, their salaries and their travel and so on, to support the original sample size. Now, BLS, Census, nobody's going to put out really poor quality data. What they will, though, have to do is perhaps cut back on the detail. I could see, for instance, unemployment rates not being available monthly anyway by various demographic groups. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but with a combination of declining response and an actual cut in sample size, it means it's like when they say plus or minus 3 percentage points, that factor gets
wider,
a lot bigger. And therefore, the headline unemployment rate is still reliable and they put it out. But a lot of the detail that they usually put out monthly may have to be curtailed if these trends keep up. And at a day and age when people want more detail from the data rather than less. But again, they won't put out data that they can't stand behind. Right. But if they can't stand behind it, it means it'll be available perhaps quarterly or annually because there'll be enough sample cases to put together.
Is the lack of budget for executing this a cut, or is it the rising costs associated with collecting the data, or a combination of the two?
It's more expensive holding interviewer costs constant to get a response, to make another call, another visit, because people just don't answer surveys the way they used to. But it is also the case that people get wage increases for interviewers. And those are usually federal employees, at least when they're working on these surveys. And those are mandated, and they should be. You know, nobody should have to take a wage cut because the agency didn't get enough money to do its full sample size. So it's really a combination of it is harder to get a response, so takes more resources to try to keep up a response rate. And then the per hour cost has also gone up, but the budgets have not gone up commensurately for that.
I mean, this is a problem that has come up quite a bit in the course of producing this show and talking to people who work in political data gathering, because obviously they want extremely high quality data that they can stand behind.
Yes.
And so they rely on the voter file, for example, in order to do that. They rely on probabilistic sampling methods. Whereas over in my neck of the woods, we're using a lot of online sample providers. Yes. I did 2 episodes about the inauthentic behavior challenge of online sample. The non-response piece is something that you identify in the report. I think it's under the environmental headwinds section. This is something that just does keep coming up. And I think I saw in one of the job report articles that I read that there's a risk of in, you know, less populous states that you might wind up with a situation where you can't report much about the employment rate in a state because you just don't have enough response to be able to say anything.
That's correct.
Is my industry making this a problem? Are we doing too many surveys and this is why people don't respond to surveys anymore? What do you think is going on?
It's a good question. Again, I'm in my early 80s, and when I was a kid, getting a long distance phone call was a big deal. Getting a phone call from a survey group that, you know, they might have been asking about brands for chicken a la king or something, but it was a big deal. Survey responses have been declining for a long time. These government surveys have historically done extremely well, but I was just looking at these charts. Really, the last 15 or so years, I would say they have taken more of a steeper decline. And some of that, we speculate, is tied in the case of the federal surveys to distrust in government. The Pew Research Center has done work on that. And that's been going down for a long time, but there was a blip up after 9/11 and then a down. And then COVID really put a number on this. So that you have these much steeper slopes of response rates declining. Well, the federal government, too, every webpage you go to, will you take a minute, you know, and give us your comments on that? I just go, you know, I'm looking for something. I don't have time for this. So what used to be a standard in the industry of a random digit dialing surveys, the gentleman who invented that, in effect, was a leading Census Bureau statistician who went into the private sector. So he saw the inauguration of that and then the demise as cell phones took over and, you know, you couldn't do it. So it is a real problem. And it may also, for again, because my interest is primarily in having these government surveys be as best as they can, what I might call civic education and a culture of data use and knowing where your data is coming from and using it responsibly and so on. If people were more aware, for instance, of the statistical agencies and what they do, one of the examples that really spoke to us when we were collecting examples in a report is a survey that the National Center for Health Statistics has done for a long time. And Haines, it's called National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, where they actually have these mobile labs going around that are all outfitted to examine you and do what you would do in a doctor's office and all kinds of blood tests. They provided the data on lead in kids' blood that helped get us all off the dime and get lead out of gasoline and other sources. That survey is suffering from considerable non-response, and it's a very expensive survey, and they need to really totally rethink how they do it. But people don't know. They don't know this.
Yeah.
And in fact, people do know there's a census generally in a Census Bureau. But a number of these agencies are so buried in their departments that if you go and look for their data, their department, or in the case of the National Center for Health Statistics, it's part of CDC. And the CD logo is up there, you know, real big. They need branding, including that the principal agencies, just the one line that says, we are a principal federal statistical agency, and click here if you want to know what that means. And it's not that people have to, you know all this history, but just to have an awareness of the value and the need, and that no matter what political party or persuasion you are, you don't need data that are cooked, you know, to suit a particular interest. You need data coming out from a trusted, objective, properly funded and resourced agency that can do the best job possible. But on where you started, are we over-surveyed? I think yes, but not, I don't see us going away from that. Yeah. You know, so
I mean, it is a funny thing, because I think in the last several years, I've started to think more about, is there another way that I could get this information so that I'm not wasting people's time asking them, but also not, it's the same thing with like reporting on your employment or your income. People are not great at answering some of those questions. And maybe I can find that some other way.
Well, that's, again, my thing about blended data for things like income, spending, wealth, because people are just, they may answer your survey, but they don't tell you all about their, say, their income, or they don't give you very great answers when they do give you an answer. It's where we need to be able to get this administrative data to fill in the gaps and where the legal barriers right now.
So the other reason that I wanted to talk to you was some of the suggestions are very much about budget and sharing of resources and protecting information, coping with these non-response issues. But there is another side of this, which is moments of interference politically in data collection. Yes. I think we should talk about why it's important to protect these statistical agencies from either overtly political influence or just inexpert influence. You know, agency heads that aren't that engaged, don't understand what it's for, starved of resources, something like that.
Yes, it is really important to have, again, objective, quality, trusted statistics. And the examples we had from other countries were governments that had some problem out of control, like inflation in Argentina, and they literally fired people and sat on people in the statistical office, and it was really, really bad. We have never quite had that, but statistical agency heads will tell you that it doesn't matter which party, which administration, they always get, well, couldn't you hold this up until after the election? Or couldn't you put it out right now? You know, that kind of thing. And there are statistical policy directives that the chief statistician's office has issued over the years to try to put up barriers. Things like the unemployment rate are released at this time and not any other time, and policy officials can see it now but not earlier. There have also been some more egregious cases that we talk about, and some in our past as well. The problem is there will always be people who, oh, well, the government, you know, I don't trust them to do anything right, and they're probably making this up, you know, and that kind of thing. But if you were to lose credibility, you as a statistical agency with more informed data users, this would be really too bad for everybody, because when push comes to shove, we do need to know whether unemployment, for instance, or inflation is getting worse or better. And having the exact magnitude, you know, there will always be some error in any statistic, but everybody benefits from a level playing field. And that gets me actually the story of this Evidence Act, because Congressman Paul Ryan, back about 10 years ago, was interested in the war on poverty and what had worked and not worked, and was told by some academics that, well, we're not really that sure because we can't use this administrative data to fill in these reporting gaps. You know, people don't report that they got food stamps or school lunch, and then higher income people underreport their property income right. and often don't respond at all to surveys. So that led in Ryan's mind to an interest in having better data for evidence. And he teamed up with Patty Murray. Supposedly he said to Patty, you know, I'm Republican, you're a Democrat, but on this one, we can all agree. So they first passed an act in 2016 that set up a congressional commission to issue a report on this issue and what was needed for evidence building. The commission was co-chaired by Catherine Abraham, who used to be commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics and was in President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, a very serious, well-respected economist, and Ron Haskins, who used to run the House Ways and Means Committee for the Republicans and the staff, and then has been a senior fellow at Brookings and also very good guy. So they issued a report, and their report said some of the things that we're saying in our report. The recommendations that were picked up for the Evidence Act were, I will say, the easier recommendations. The codification of this confidential information protection, the saying that all statistical agencies are charged to produce reliable and objective and so on data. That legislation also set up another commission or committee to advise on the idea of a national secure data set, a service where records could be linked securely, but they would reside back with whoever had the records, so you wouldn't have this Big Brother data warehouse thing. But they did not tackle, for instance, sharing of IRS data that I said is still not possible. They did not tackle in the Evidence Act, what about states that have records for programs that the feds fund and that really ought to be available for evidence? But they did a lot. And they required every cabinet office independent agency to have an evaluation officer. There were already chief information officers, and they were also to set up a chief data officer and a statistical official. So they set up this apparatus to try to get the federal government more active on data for evidence building. And that's now been working out, and there have been some successes and some, of course, anything that involves groups of people and these different types of people working together. But it spawned this idea that evaluation was really important, that you didn't just change a program because you felt or some constituent said, I don't like this right. or whatever. You tried to have evidence. And it is to Congressman Ryan's credit and Patty Murray's credit that they passed this. It hasn't gone far enough, which is what our report is about, but it set a structure in place and it helped elevate the statistical agencies. Again, not enough, but it helped. And there are supposed to be some regulations coming out from OMB to give meat to some of the things that are in the Evidence Act. So it is quite an achievement. It is one, of course, that any administration that doesn't care that much about evidence could easily short circuit and slow down and all that. But it has created some momentum to try to get, again, the whole government adopting an evidence approach to policy.
This may be a question that is better aimed at an administrative law professor. but in the most recent issuance of opinions from the Supreme Court, we do have this overturning of what's known as Chevron deference, which is basically saying that judges should defer to agency representatives who are in an expert position to determine how best to execute the will of Congress through the executive agency.
Right.
You know, to your point earlier about some congressional expenditures are based on formulas.
They are formulas, yes.
They probably also need to be updated from time to time.
They do, time to time, yes.
And then I would imagine that there are also more qualitative frameworks for making agency decisions as well. As I was reading through this report, it seemed like that is also a little bit of a warning light. If we're going to start allowing judges to decide what they think, whether or not they think Congress empowered that agency to do that, and then also what they think Congress wants, then it means that there's a lot more rulemaking that they seem to expect Congress to do. But this is a very big, yes, complicated country now. To your point about the expansion of all these agencies and the statistical agencies within them, are you concerned about that side of things, that kind of removal of deference to agency experts who would be able to figure this out?
I am concerned. We talk about professional autonomy for the statistical agencies, and we make a distinction. They, of course, need to be accountable to the public and Congress for data on crime or education. Right. And we need better data on measuring the gig economy or AI effects. And that is perfectly legitimate political guidance to the agencies. What we mean by professional autonomy is that the agency should be able to decide with its expertise, are we going to start with in-person and follow up with telephone? When are we going to change some survey, like the current population survey? They are now working on giving an online internet option, which makes sense, but is not a slam dunk because different people respond differently. That should not be an issue that Congress or a higher up political is meddling in. There was a big controversy about the citizenship question on the census the last time. And it is asked on the American Community Survey, on the CPS, on other surveys with no problem. American Community Survey estimates are used for parts of the Voting Rights Act, and other countries, not all of them, but some of them have citizenship on their census. But in our country, with the fraught state of different views on immigration and with the need to have an accurate count in the census, it seemed pretty clear to many people, and I will include myself, that having a question on citizenship in the U.S. census did not make a lot of sense. There are borderline issues where a statistical agency can say, yeah, if you order us to do this, be prepared that there's going to be this huge undercount in the immigrant community. And there is some evidence that that undercount actually occurred in 2020. There was a bigger Hispanic undercount than before. So anything like Chevron, and to be truthful, again, I am not a lawyer, but why Supreme Court justices would think that, I mean, they are experts supposedly in constitutional law, right? Not in medicine, for instance, or in whatever. So yes, that is a worry. People can use lawsuits. Lawsuits have been brought for many censuses saying to the Census Bureau, you should only count people who are here legally. The Census Bureau has always been able to bat back those lawsuits by saying we can't really make that determination and that we will affect the accuracy of the census if we were to even try. So under Chevron, would that argument carry weight? I don't know. It might, it might not. It seems to be up to the particular justices who are on the court at a particular time. The census is very close to Congress. For instance, there was a law passed in the 90s that said, we need more up-to-date estimates of school-age children living in poor families to make Title I education fund allocations to states and school districts. They were using the census, which used to have the questions that are now on the American Community Survey on their long-form sample. And it was too long. You went a decade or more, and things were getting out of whack. So they told the Census Bureau, you know, we want you to do this, but they did not tell the Census Bureau how to do it. What they did do, actually, was tell the National Academy of Sciences to set up an expert committee to look at how the Census Bureau was doing and to make recommendations. And I was involved with that project. But it would have been very inappropriate for Congress to say, well, you should use these data and this type of model and you should do this. That would be totally inappropriate. The reason we have agencies and a fair amount of delegation to agencies is because Congress has limited time and attention, and be very hard for them to do this kind of micromanaging. So that was an example of a law that said, we need this kind of data. And it was something the Census Bureau could do and would not adversely affect anything else, like the citizenship question affecting the undercount. And the Census Bureau then went to work with an approach, and our committee at the National Academies wrote a bunch of reports. We critiqued it initially, and then they made improvements, and then we said it was good, and it's still going, this program. So it's still used for these allocations.
Yeah.
And they've improved along the way.
Yeah. I mean, I would have to go check, but I'm not sure how many statisticians go run for Congress.
There aren't very many. There have been a few political scientists over the years. But, you know, they're mainly lawyers or business people, and there's no reason for them to be expert in a whole bunch of areas.
Yes. Well, and to your point also, you know, judges appointed to the High Court tend not to also be, you know, they've been lawyers. They've been judges most of the time.
Right.
So as we come to a close, I'm just curious about, what do you see as kind of, you've got a whole recommendation section, so I'm not going to ask you to recite it. For an audience that is primarily people who work in business, work with data, work in politics with data, what would you want them to take away from this report? What are kind of the key recommendations you're making, and how can they support this set of recommendations?
A key message is the value of objective, high-quality statistics. There is not just the U.S., the Academy says, of principles and practices for a federal statistical agency. The U.N. has fundamental principles for official statistics, and it starts out by saying the citizens are entitled to high-quality, objective, useful statistics, and that only the government can provide these basic statistics. People often say, well, why not have the private sector collect the data? And they do collect a lot of data. But there's no business case for doing a census or an American community survey or a current population survey where you're trying to cover the whole population. Many companies do, again, add value to the basic federal statistics. So I would ask folks out there in the polling industry and market research to try to be as self-aware as possible of where the underlying data are coming from that they often use to benchmark their own data or adjust it to represent the population when they get these really small response rates from public opinion polls. Not just the U.S. Census Bureau, but the particular survey. If there are particular agencies' data that they use in particular, there are various groups out there. There's something called the Census Project for the Census Bureau. There are the Friends of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Friends of the National Center for Health Statistics. Take a little time to become aware of that and communicate with folks who are involved in that, and with, which is something easy to forget here in D.C. because we are not a state, but educating one's local congressperson and senators can be really important on this. Yes, we, the private sector, are doing a whole lot of data collection, but in many ways, without the federal statistics, we would be lost. And again, I give an example. I believe it was the case that the presidential polling in 2016 and their postmortems, they realized they needed an education break. Which means, of course, they needed such a question to ask themselves, but then they needed the federal statistics to show them how they should make sure that their respondents were properly representing the different groups in the population. So without the federal statistics, again, the whole public opinion and even market research would be having difficulties, shall we say. Yeah. And then, of course, just as a citizen of a community and a town or a county or a state, those entities are relying on federal statistics all the time to figure out, again, where schools should go or police stations or daycare or apply for grants for federal programs, that kind of thing. Again, getting a little more awareness of the fact that we have a highly qualified but decentralized system, which can make it easy to lose some of these agencies in the weeds. Whenever anybody says, oh, the private sector can collect all this, point out why, in fact, this is not true and the private sector needs those data. And in fact, I heard a really good story about that, a company wanting to locate a plant and needing information on the labor force and education and so on. The company did not want what the localities were telling them. They wanted federal statistics that they knew were consistently collected across the nation that they could use to make their decision, because they were comparing different localities in different states and needed that consistency and the quality and the objectivity that they weren't necessarily going to get from folks who were invested in Best Foot Forward and so on for their communities. That was an interesting one.
Yeah. I think that's really helpful. When I saw this report had come out, maybe it's because I really do rely on federal statistics very frequently, and I immediately was worried, but glad to see someone taking a look at all of the challenges just from a institutional support, budgetary support, the need to innovate, the problem everyone's coping with, non-response challenges. But also, I think one of the most important things about the report, and the reason I definitely want to share it in the show notes, and we have a newsletter that goes out with the show as well, is there are very real results if we don't have this information. Yeah. There are incredibly important things that we have been able to accomplish as a country because we have this information. The lead example is a great one. School funding, just the ability to know what the GDP is, to know whether we're in a recession or not. Your example, where do I put a new plant or a new office park? You know, all of those things are incredible, important private sector, public sector, citizenship questions. And I'm so grateful for you taking the time to step me through the history of all of this and the findings that you and your team came up with in this report, The Nation's Data at Risk, because I think it's really important for people in my field, for sure, to know about it.
Well, thank you. It was just a delight to talk with you. I kind of fell into federal statistics. I use census data in my political science, my PhD dissertation. And when we came to Washington, we thought we were going to be here just a year for my husband to do work on actually Booker T. Washington's papers from the Library of Congress. And I needed, you know, one of us needed a job. And so I sort of fell into a job at the Census Bureau and made then a career in federal statistics. I was part of a unit at the Census Bureau that helped data users use the cornucopia of data that came out when they were able to shift from just printed reports to computer files. And the 1970 census was the first one to do that on a big scale. And so having federal statistics that are accessible and able to maintain the quality and the accessibility is just really, really important to me.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.